Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Survival stories. I'm your host, Casey McIntosh, joined by Julie Henningsen. How are you doing today, Julie?
Good, Casey. Glad to be here again. I'm excited to hear what story you're going to share with us this week.
Well, I'm glad that you're here with me, Julie. I'm taking us back a little bit into history, World War II era. Are you aware of the Gremlin Special? Have you heard of this story before?
No. Oh, I'm intrigued. I've never heard of it. I just think of the 1980s movie when I hear the word gremlin.
Yeah, me too. You know what? I think that they used the word gremlin maybe later on in the movie, inspired by this airplane that was also called the Gremlin. So today we're going to delve into the remarkable tale of the Gremlin Special, which is a Douglas C-47 Skytrain that met with disaster during a sightseeing flight over the Baleen Valley, also known as Shangri-La Valley, in New Guinea in 1945.
Oh, yes, I do. This does ring a distant bell. Oh, this is going to be good.
This story highlights the journey of three survivors that were stranded in an isolated valley amidst treacherous terrain, enemy forces, indigenous populations, and they captured global attention and became a symbol of resilience. And also, it was just at the end of World War II, but this big story that really inspired the imagination of people around the world. So before we get into the meat of this story, I was just going to go into a little information about one of the protagonists in this story, who ended up being called the Queen of Shangri-La.
Ooh.
So before May 13th, 1945, hardly anybody knew who Margaret Hastings was outside of her family and her friends in the army. She was just an average girl. She was living her life and serving her country. But everything changed in a blink of an eye after this story, and she was in the headlines everywhere and was the celebrity. Margaret was known as Maggie. She was born in Pennsylvania in 1914, and she grew up in Owego, New York. She was remembered as the Spitfire who was always getting into trouble. She had a little bit of a rebellious streak, but also all of the men seemed to really like her. She was super cute, really spunky, and she was little. She was only 5'2" tall, and she was about 100 pounds. So petite Spitfire. She sounds like a lot of fun. When World War II kicked off in 1941, she was in her late 20s, and she was single. She was working as a secretary. She decided to enlist in January of 44 in the Women's Army Corps, and she ended up in basic training, and she earned herself rank of corporal. In December of 44, Margaret got shipped out to New Guinea with some of her fellow Women Army Corps members, and she was stationed at USAAF base in Hollandia, a jungle-backed port city right in the middle of New Guinea. And, you know, as I was reading about Margaret, I just became curious about what it was like to be a woman during World War II.
That too. That's something you don't hear a lot about, the Women's Corps. I'd love to hear more about that.
This is just really brief because we could get into this for hours and get into the weeds. But during World War II, nearly 350,000 American women stepped up to serve the country. And they had diverse roles. From a lot of them were doing office work, but some of them were driving trucks and repairing airplanes and serving as nurses near the front lines. So they did a lot during World War II, but it did not come without difficulty. You just have to consider the controversy of women in the military, because women were never perceived as leaders before that point. And it really rocked the boat in terms of people's idea about social norms. So there were debates about why women shouldn't be in the military, you know, things like, oh, women shouldn't be in harm's way. And then other countries were questioning the manhood of people in the United States, like all these women are doing these men jobs. And also the attire, because the women were wearing, you know, pants And I read something about how this idea of women wearing, you know, quote unquote, men's clothing was a violation of public decency, which is absurd.
Yeah, it sounds like they were looking for an excuse there. That's a little stretch.
Right. It's not like they're wearing less clothes. They're probably wearing more clothes. And, you know, it's indecent, apparently. But there were also rumors and accusations that they were there only for men to, like, improve morale and do, you know, sexual favors and, you know, basically anything to put a woman down is right. What I'm getting at.
Sounds like they're coming at it from all possible angles there, the critic.
Of course. Why wouldn't they?
Yeah.
Okay. So I'm digressing, but back to our story. So around the time of this story, World War II was really winding down. But the women in Hollandia were told if the Japanese came, so the place that they were stationed had been a Japanese stronghold at one point. They were told that should the Japanese come after them, that they should basically commit suicide.
Mm, wow.
So yeah, even though Hollandia wasn't exactly a hotspot in the war at that point, the stakes were pretty high. In any case, the war was winding down and, you know, it's just like getting to that point where things were coming to a close. So picture this. It's Sunday, May 13th, 1945. Colonel Peter Prossen was the maintenance chief of USAAF's Far East Air Service Command in Hollandia. He gets this idea. He decides to arrange a little adventure of sightseeing, flight over the interior of New Guinea in the Douglas C-47 Skytrain, which is also known as the Gremlin.
Okay.
It's Mother's Day. Their journey takes them to a lush valley, which is tucked away in the journey takes them to this lush valley tucked away in the Anj Mountains, which now we know as the Jaya Mountains. The valley that they're flying over was originally known as Hidden Valley, or it was called Hidden Valley by a pilot who stumbled upon the valley a year before. And it's like something out of a storybook. It's basically these green, lush, towering peaks and huge valleys. And the valley is about 150 miles away from Hollandia by air. And when you look down at this island valley, it basically is completely isolated. There's not really any pathway in or out.
Okay. So it's not like surrounded by a passable range where you could hike in or hike out.
It's pretty remote. And this Balian Valley is nestled within the central highlands of Western New Guinea. It's approximately 80 kilometers and the length, 80 kilometers in length and 20 kilometers in width. The valley was discovered by Richard Archibald, who was a zoologist in 1938. But I think what was really interesting for everyone once they learned about this place is the fact that there are a ton of indigenous tribes that live here, and they're known for cannibalism. So of course, everyone gets their imagination start soaring and thinking about all sorts of crazy things that might be going on there.
Yeah. And so theoretically, these indigenous tribes are people that have maybe never left this valley.
Right. They're hunters and gatherers, and they're living probably true to their culture from eons ago.
Yeah, and they probably, in that kind of landscape and climate, they probably have a lot of good natural resources to just keep plugging away with their lifestyle.
Right. And I was kind of surprised because the valley has over 200,000 indigenous people. One of the one that is most common is the Dani people. That's the tribe that a lot of the people knew about. So anyway, on the fateful afternoon of our story, there were 24 Army personnel, including 9 Women's Army Corps. They hop aboard the C-47 Gremlin Special. Prossen is the pilot. He takes to the controls and off they go. They're off for some sightseeing. The other thing that I will say is that this area, the Americans who'd come to Hollandia were transfixed by the beauty of the area to the point that the Army Air Force pilots gave regular tours for sightseeing. And one of them had dubbed it Shangri-La and the name just stuck. So this is a pretty common thing to do.
Do a little flyover of this Shangri-La Valley.
Exactly. I think probably just this whole concept of these cannibalists inhabiting the valley below, and also these incredibly huge mountains. Some of them are up to 9,000 feet of elevation. It's pretty dramatic, right? And
I'm sure the landscape is impressive.
Right, just beautiful. So they're flying along, and as they approach the valley, these clouds start rolling in, and the pilot loses visibility. He tries to get his bearings, and he made a horrible decision. He decides to descend, thinking that maybe if he goes down lower, he'll have better visualization. But really, the problem is that they're right by a mountain. Mm-hmm. So he flies right into the side of the mountain. And on impact, Colonel Prossen and his co-pilot, Major George H. Nicholson, they die immediately.
Mm.
And a lot of them had burns, so I'm assuming that the plane must have been on fire at some point. Mentioned our female service member that I mentioned earlier, Hastings, she had some burns on her legs, but she was able to get out of the plane. And two other survivors were Lieutenant John S. McCollum and Staff Sergeant Kenneth W. Decker. McCollum's injuries included just a few minor cuts and bruises. Decker, it sounds like he, of the surviving people, had more significant injuries. He had a broken arm, severe burns, and a head injury.
Mm.
But they were in the best condition. A lot of the other people just died on impact. And then there were two other individuals that were still alive, which were Laura Bealey and Eleanor P. Hanna. And both of them died shortly from injuries. Hanna on May 15th of severe burns, and Bealey on May 15th from internal injuries. So remember, this was on the 13th that the crash occurred.
Okay, so they survived just a couple days.
Right.
What a tragedy when they'd been serving in World War II, and just think of all of the challenges that they had probably faced up to this point, and all of the fears and dangerous situations they've been in, and thinking about how to commit suicide if they encountered the enemy. And then it's just like a joyride, a sightseeing tour that they meet their demise. Oh, such a tragedy. Yeah.
It is a tragedy. And unfortunately, the story, I think part of the problem was that our protagonist woman was so darn adorable, and everybody was just so enamored with her that it kind of overshadowed the loss of all of these other people.
Mm. Yeah.
It was just like news bait. You know what I mean?
Yeah. There was no clickbait back then, but there was.
News bait, no clickbait. So Prossen was the pilot. He had listed his destination as Shangri-La on the flight plan, and that was all he said. He didn't indicate really the direction he was going or anything else. So it wasn't very helpful for rescuers. And I'm sure it's just like, okay, it's a sightseeing flight. We're going to be back soon. It's not a big deal. We do this all the time. And I'm imagining that's why he didn't put any more details. But in any case, the whole point is that even though they recognized that the plane had not come back, it took 72 hours to find the wreckage out there in the jungle because there was no indication of which direction they were going. Our three survivors decided to hike a few miles to a clearing that McCollum had spotted because they wanted to have better visualization of any airplanes that were going overhead. And shortly after, they made contact with local villagers. And at one point, some of the local villagers actually brought them food. They were treated very kindly by the indigenous people, despite the, you know, reputation.
Yeah, and I wonder if they were curious about what the food was, though.
Right, I'm sure. That's a good point. So the rescuers were able to see the survivors, and that helped them kind of locate the wreckage, but they weren't able to land. There was nowhere to land, you know, on this little clearing. So they ended up dropping medical supplies and food and even beer. They also dropped walkie-talkies so they could radio back and forth.
Great.
So on May 20th, there's a rescue team with Captain C. Earl Walter Jr., who led 8 Filipino-American paratroopers, and they jumped into the heart of the valley. And I want you to just picture this. Upon landing, they were met by hundreds of spear-carrying tribesmen. What a welcome.
Oh my gosh. Wow. Talk about intimidating.
Right? you know, of course, there's no communication that can happen between the groups. So I'm sure that was pretty riveting for everyone involved. I'm sure if you're an indigenous tribe person and someone comes flying from the sky, can you even imagine what your thoughts would be at that point?
No. Yeah. It reminds me of this also a 1980s movie called The Gods Must Be Crazy. Have you ever heard that movie? And they drop a somebody drops a Coke bottle out of an airplane and it's found by an indigenous person who's never seen anything like it before. And it just like changes his life.
Yeah, it's just mind-altering, mind-blowing. Yeah. On May 22nd, Walter and the five paratroopers and two medics, they hike into the jungle to go find the survivors. And they're going to treat the injuries because some of them have gangrene, which I'm assuming the person with gangrene is probably Decker, who had most of the injuries. On May 29th, Walter and the paratroopers. Okay, so first of all, I want to say that that is a really long hike through the jungle. I guess it's only 3 days, but I'm sure that felt like forever.
Right.
On May 29th, Walter and the paratroopers hiked the plane wreckage from the clearing, and they bury the dead while a plane overhead with chaplains recite prayers. And the pilots up there in the sky performed funeral rites, and then they drop wooden crosses and even a Star of David to mark the spot where the individuals who didn't make it were laid to rest.
That's thoughtful.
Yeah. On June 15th, Walter leads the survivors back through the jungle to the big valley, and they reach the valley on June 18th and they set up a camp. So at this point, this whole thing has gone on over a whole month. These survivors have been out there in the jungle for over 4 weeks at this point. What's really interesting is that the Army was keeping this really hush-hush at first. It took almost a whole month for news to make it back to the United States. And even then, the reports were very conflicting. There were details that were mixed up with people's names and the injuries and probably the death numbers as well. And of course, when the crash got out, the big news agencies, they sent reporters to cover the story. And, you know, of course, they latched on to the whole Shangri-La angle of, you know, the mythical hidden valley, all sorts, you know, filled with all sorts of cannibalists doing crazy rituals with human skulls and, you know, all of those things.
Right. They probably did some embellishing of what might have actually been going on.
Exactly. Once this rescuer guy, which was Walter, once he gets back with the survivors, the paratroopers and Walter and then some of these Dani tribesmen tried to create a runway, trying to think, you know, somebody might be able to land. So in my imagination, this is just a very lush area with lots and lots of growth everywhere. It's kind of crazy that no one had tried to land there before, but I guess maybe they had no reason to.
Right.
They ultimately decided to land a Waco CG-4A glider on this landing strip. And they were going to load survivors and paratroopers aboard and then yank this engineless aircraft back into the air. So it's essentially going to be picked up by the airplane.
So I'm just trying to picture this. So the glider glides in, they load the people up, and then an airplane somehow does like a flyby and snags it and pulls it out.
Yeah. Wow. So there's a low-flying C-47, which is the same aircraft that crashed. The C-47 has a dangling steel hook, and it's going to snatch the glider's tow rope, and the rescuers would suspend above the ground by two poles. So there's this hook that's attached to 1,000 feet of steel cable on a winch, which would reduce some of the shock with the loading. I guess it's kind of hard to picture like this whole thing.
Yeah, like it would be so jerky.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
So this would make you feel really great if you were one of the survivors, because until March of 1945, this system had only been used to retrieve empty gliders, maybe with some supplies. Although there had been a medevac mission conducted that month that showed that it could be done with a glider carrying human passengers. But I'm not sure about you, Julie. That sounds terrifying, especially after a plane crash. Like, yeah, let's just go on this engineless glider and you know what I mean? Ah.
Exactly. Don't worry. It's been done one other time.
And apparently, Apparently, there were some disastrous practice attempts, but they finally figured out how to do this. And on June 28th, 1945, they dropped the glider into the valley. So there was a Canadian adventurer named Alexander Kahn. He parachuted into the valley with a film camera to document the rescue on behalf of the Netherlands Indies Information Service. And there's a 12-minute documentary that he filmed called Rescue from Shangri-La, and you can watch it on YouTube, which I think should all probably watch this on YouTube.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, so on June 28th, Margaret Hastings, McCollum, Decker, and the two paratrooper medics hop into this glider, which is piloted by Lieutenant Henry Palmer. And just 30 minutes after the glider landed on the rough strip, a low-flying C-47 swoops in, snatches up the glider, zooms off, climbing high to avoid the surrounding peaks.
Mm-hmm.
This nerve-wracking flight back to Hollandia takes about an hour and 20 minutes, but finally they make it back.
Amazing.
Yes. And guess what? There's a huge crowd waiting on the airstrip to welcome these three survivors back, who've been stranded for 47 days.
Wow.
Right?
In Shangri-La.
In Shangri-La.
I mean, when I think of places to be stranded for 47 days, I would say Shangri-La might be close to the top of the list.
Yeah? Yeah, I mean, at least they had all provisions and things that they needed.
Exactly. They had a support team and rations and yeah.
Could be worse, for sure. Now, once they're back, the media goes absolutely wild, especially with Margaret Hastings' story. And initial reports said that she looked extraordinarily fit after the whole ordeal. And they described her, of course.
The reports are going to comment on the appearance of the one woman.
Of course. And it doesn't help that she's just already really pretty to begin with.
Yeah, right.
They described her like she came back from a beach vacation, you know, with sparkling hazel eyes and a nice tan. And at a press conference, she's all freshened up with a new hairdo and snazzy clothes and bright red nail polish, looking like she's ready to hit the town.
I want to know what the men's hair looked like at the conference. What was their hair looking like?
I'm sure it was looking good.
Critical information. Left out of that story.
For sure. Some newspapers even dubbed her the most celebrated young woman of the war.
Oh, wow. And
basically, she was turned into a pinup girl called the number one adventure girl in World War II.
Hmm.
So after the crash, the Army wasn't too keen on admitting their mistakes, and they twisted the story a little bit to make it a bit less embarrassing. They called this joyride that turned fatal an orientation flight. And they emphasized how the survivors tried to help others who sadly didn't make it. So it was pretty much, you know, trying to cover up things after the fact.
Sure. And said this, what happened to the Filipino-American paratroopers?
Yeah, so I'm imagining that they probably, I don't know how many people could go on this glider at a time.
So maybe they did a few trips.
Yeah, that's my guess.
Yeah.
Just nobody cares about them, Julie. The only one.
Just get over what happened to them.
Yeah.
You're right.
I mean, if we're not talking about a young, beautiful, single woman.
Adventure queen,
pinup girl. I don't know why we care about these paratroopers. Yeah. I mean, really.
Boring.
Exactly. So before the rescue, Army spokespeople were bad-mouthing the Dani people as headhunters, but afterwards they changed the tune, saying that they were very happy people, even though they were allegedly described at some point as living in absolute filth.
But, oh.
Yeah, I don't know about that. There was also a rumor going around that the Dani wanted to make Margaret Hastings queen of the valley, and a reporter asked her about it and she just laughed it off.
Hmm.
But that's hence the name, you know, Queen of Shangri-La.
Got it. Yeah.
So after they made it home, the Army just didn't want this story to end. They sent Margaret and the others on a Liberty Bond tour around the country for 7 weeks.
Wow. They're really spinning this.
Oh, right. Totally. Margaret really got tired of repeating this story over and over again. And she eventually mentioned somewhere along the lines that she should have been nicer to people. She just really was over it.
Yeah, understandably.
Eventually, she settled into civilian life. She took a job as a hotel secretary in New York City, and she met her future husband, Robert C. Atkinson. They got married in 1949, and Margaret's story just continued to capture people's interest. She even appeared on a TV show called This Is Your Life. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until much later that the real story of the crash and rescue came out. In 1997, a retired Army Air Force colonel wrote about it in a book, and in 2011, another author debunked the myths and propaganda surrounding the crash. So sometimes it just takes some time for the truth to come out. And I think all of the details and, you know, this adventure and all of these things surrounding the story, it was, what's the word I'm looking for? Glamorized.
Glamorized.
Yeah.
Yep.
And you wonder, I mean, if there were three men survivors, I don't know that that would have been the case, but who's to say?
Oh, it does put a human interest spin to have Margaret kind of be the face of the story and the adventure.
Right. And of course, people are wondering if anything happened between her and one of the men, you know?
I'm sure that was the first thing they were thinking of when they got out of a wrecked plane, lost their co-workers and friends, and were stranded in a remote valley.
I'm sure. I mean, when opportunity presents itself.